Afternoon, council and parties. Welcome to Division Two of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases set on the 1:30 docket for oral argument. First is in re Estate of Gomez. Council president ready in that case? Very well. We'll take that case first. Second case is Waste Management versus City of Commerce City. Council president ready in that case?
We are, Your Honor.
All right. Bailiff, has somebody checked in for the other side yet? All right, good. We'll take that case second. For those of you who may not have argued here before, let me briefly review the ground rules. These cases are set for 30 minutes or 15 minutes per side, rather, 30 minutes total. You'll be guided by a lighting system on the podium, which works as follows. When your time begins, the green light comes on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light comes on. And when your time has totally expired, the red light will come on. You'll be guided by the clock on the podium, which counts backwards from 15. The appellants, now I know we've got cross appeals in this case, but the appellant may have any time you wish for rebuttal. We're going to ask the respondent and cross appellant simply to present the whole argument at once on that particular case. The podium adjusts upward and downward by the use of a toggle switch, so feel free to use that. We would ask you to stay close to the podium because we're recording your arguments today, and we sometimes go back and listen to the tapes again for additional help, and if you stray from the podium, it will not pick up your voice well. We've read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you set them forth, so to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us, but the case is yours to argue as you wish. Finally, if anybody in the audience has a cell phone or a pager or other electronic device, please ensure it's turned off at this time. We're ready for argument.
Good afternoon. My name is Josh Mack, and I'm here representing my clients, Janella Jarvis and George Hudgens, who are seated to my right. My clients are appealing a ruling of the district court in which the court invalidated their mother, Jewel Gomez's, will in order to approximate what it saw as the joint intent of Jewel and her husband, Art. The court utilized the doctrine of undue influence to do this. This doctrine is admittedly not well defined in Colorado. And it did this in order to give a greater bequest to Art's daughter, Cynthia Ranson Gomez. The problem with this holding is twofold. First, the holding that the will is the product of undue influence is directly conflicts with the court's own factual findings. And second, the court reached this holding in order to approximate the couple's intent, even though there were no agreements between Jewel and Art with respect to their wills. The court invalidated Jewel's will in order to enforce a contract that never existed. We're asking this court to reverse the district court's holding that Jewel's will was the product of undue influence, uphold the district court's finding that Art's will is valid, and order that both wills be admitted to probate. Now, the court explained its reasoning for its holding when it stated Jewel did not intend the result which was obtained, the three-quarters, one-quarter distribution. In fact, at the conclusion of its ruling, the court asked counsel for authority which would allow it to invalidate both wills and replace them with something which would approximate its view of the couple's intent. The court later amended this ruling to find that the will was only partially procured by undue influence in order to remedy an unexpected consequence of invalidating this will. The three-quarters, one-quarter distribution does not refer to Jewel's estate. It refers to the combined estates of Jewel and Art Gomez.
Why does that matter, counsel? If both people wanted to obtain the same disposition of their property, why isn't it relevant whether she thought she was bequeathing more than her one half?
Her intent with regard to her husband's property is not relevant because there is no contract concerning succession. Her property is hers to give as she wishes, and his property is his to give as he wishes. And the only way that those two intents can be combined is through a written contract concerning succession under 1511.514. Clearly states that there can be no contract concerning succession unless it's in writing and signed by the decedent. And it is quite clear that no such contract exists in this case.
Mr. Mack, if I can ask you to go back for a second on the intent question. If I'm understanding your argument correctly, you say there was clearly no undue influence because the will reflected, Jules' will reflected what her intent was.
Correct. Correct?
Now, her intent, what the court found, and this is where you can help me, the court found that the intent, Jules' intent as well as Art's, was at the end of the day, each family gets half. You know, Art's kids get half and Jules' kids get half. But that's not what obtained in Jules' will. So I guess what I'm asking is, I'm confused. You repeatedly say Jules' will reflected that intent, but I'm not sure how it does. The intent was this 50-50 split to the families, and it didn't on its face.
Well, the court really made two findings with respect to intent. It agreed that her intent in making a will originally was for her property to go to her children subject to a life estate for her husband. It also found that she had an intent that the couple's property together go to have a certain distribution. What I'm saying is that her intent with respect to the half of the property that belonged to her husband is irrelevant because that property is not hers to give.
Where did the court, the first finding you say the court made a finding that she had an intent for the life estate followed by half to her children?
It's in our brief when the court is discussing the testimony of Sam Maines, who is Jules' attorney. And I don't have the exact page of the transcript,
okay,
well, but it is cited in our brief.
You say in the court, I'll look for that. I don't remember it because in the post-trial motions, the court said, reaffirms its finding that the party's actual intent, was that the children of each party would receive half of the total assets of the parties when the survivor passed away. It seems to me those two intents would be inconsistent.
No, because the problem was with Art's will, not with Jules' will. The problem that the court perceived was with Art's will, not with Jules' will. Jules clearly wanted her half of the property to go to her children subject to a life estate for her husband.
See, but that's, if I can interrupt you, that's inconsistent, though, with the court's then saying wants half to go to her children and half to Cynthia.
But the problem is with Art's half of the estate. If the court is correct that there was a mistake, it was a mistake made by Art's attorney in assuming that their property was held in joint tenancy when it wasn't. It was a mistake in his will.
But let's say hypothetically, if she wanted both, say Art and Jewel wanted to have to go to each of their kids, they could have done, assuming no tax issues, whatever, could have done that directly. I want half here and half here, end of story. But it seems to me on the face of Jewel's will, if her intent was half to her kids and half to Art's daughter, on the face of it, you would look at it and say, well, if Art predeceased, that doesn't work because Cynthia gets nothing.
Right, and our argument is that she wanted her half to go to her children and that the other half was none of her business, and that whatever Art may have wanted with respect to that half, that's the mistake that the trial court thought occurred here.
But then you're challenging the court's finding in the post-trial, finding.
Well, we're not challenging that finding because the finding of mistake is not what the holding was based on. So there's nothing for us to challenge there. I mean, I would disagree with it, but it's not challenged in our brief because it's not what the court's ruling was based on. It was based on the finding of undue influence.
All right. I'm sorry to belabor this, Mr. Mack. I'll ask you one more, and then I'll leave you be. If we focus on the court's finding in the post-trial order that Jewel wanted half to go to her children and half to Art's daughter, let's assume that is the intent. Would you agree that Jewel's will on its face is not consistent with that intent?
Well, I think that question has to be more clearly defined. Half of what? She did not want half of her property to go to Art's daughter. She wanted all of her property to go to her children and wanted to allow Art to do whatever he wanted to do with his half of the property.
All right, let me just use the court's words. He finds that the party's actual intent, let's say Fuel's actual intent, was that the children of each party would receive half of the total assets of the parties. Mm-hmm. That's what the court found. So if that's true, and I know, I assume you disagree with that. If that's right, isn't it true that Jewell's will is not consistent with that?
But that you're talking about is not anything that's relevant to her will. What you intend with respect to somebody else's property is not relevant with respect to who you devise your property to. If you make a will that accurately devises your property the way you want it to be, and you have an intent with respect to someone else's property, the intent with respect to someone else's property is irrelevant because it's not yours to give.
But it's relevant to the argument you have raised, which was since the intent was what Jewell wanted, there's no undue influence. And what it seems to me is the court said the intent is not what Jewell wanted. That's why the court didn't find any rebutting of the undue influence.
Well, I think what the court found was that there was some agreement between the parties, despite the fact that there wasn't. I mean, an agreement has to be in writing. And the court found that there was an agreement between the parties that they would give half of their joint property to each of their respective descendants. And there's indisputably no contract there that can be enforced that way.
Thank you.
With respect to the standard of review in this case, we believe undue influence is a legal conclusion, which should be reviewed de novo, with strong deference to the court's factual findings. There is no specific Colorado case law parsing this out, but I think it's best explained by the Utah case, Matter of Estate of Ayub, in which the court said, we review the trial court's ultimate legal conclusions of testamentary capacity and lack of undue influence for correctness, although some deference will be accorded to the trial court in the process of reviewing certain applications of law to fact. Even in the broadest view of what is factual and what is legal, the ultimate conclusion of undue influence is a legal conclusion.
How do you square that with Kruger versus Erie that talks about the presumption of undue influence, if it's rebutted, still can be some evidence that the fact finder is to consider? Now, if it says the fact finder is to consider it, here the trial court was the fact finder.
With respect to Kruger v. Erie, I agree that both the presumption and the rebuttal of the presumption are questions of law. Here, I believe that the presumption was raised because my clients did call an attorney for their mother. We also believe that it is conclusively rebutted, both because her will followed her intent and because the court found no improper intent on their part. At that point, we're basically left where we started with all of that evidence that was used to create the presumption and to rebut it. And that evidence is then what is used to reach the ultimate legal conclusion of undue influence or lack thereof.
When you say improper intent, what does that encompass?
Well, the court stated, on the issue of undue influence, I am finding that Jewell's will was procured by undue influence. Now, I want to make it very clear that I am not suggesting that Mr. Hudgens or Miss Jarvis had any evil motive or intent. I don't think that was precise wording, but I think based on the nature of what undue influence is, it's inconsistent with the finding of undue influence. Undue influence is wrongdoing. Influencing someone to give you more of their property than they want to is wrongdoing, and undue influence has been described as fraud by numerous cases that are cited in our brief. As such, the court's holding was basically that our clients committed fraud without any improper intent, which is an inconsistent legal conclusion. This concludes my opening argument. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Eileen Paez. I represent Cindy Gomez Ranson. Ms. Ranson is a teacher in New Jersey. She was not able to make it here today. I believe that the central point that I would like to make today is the Canterbury case should not have been applied retroactively to the facts in this situation. I believe that our reply brief sets that out quite clearly as to what the standard is that the court should have applied in deciding whether or not to retroactively apply the Canterbury case. Particularly, the cases cited in Canterbury and cited by the appellant are not factually similar. In the Hendrickson case decided in Mississippi, the husband was the one who put the property into joint tenancy, and it was the husband who took it out of joint tenancy. In this case, it was the husband who put the property into joint tenancy, and the wife, with the assistance of her children, who took it out of joint tenancy. In the Knickerbocker case, the change was made during a divorce proceeding so that the confidential relationship between the parties was over at that time, whereas in this case, there was never any evidence at all that there was any dispute between Jewel and Art as to what should happen to their property or how that property should be held. It was Art who put the property into the joint tenancy in order to give Jewel an interest should he die first.
Ms. Pius, how do you square that with the somewhat categorical statement in Canterbury that a joint tenant has the absolute right to sever a joint tenancy and create a tenancy in common?
I agree that the Canterbury Supreme Court did say that, but at the time that Jewel executed that bargain and sale deed, taking it out of joint tenancy, the law was the Canterbury case decided by the Court of Appeals.
How can that be given that the case was still not final? It was on appeal. It was on writ of certiorari.
Well, I think that can be addressed through the decisions cited in the reply brief that follow the Chevron Oil case that talk about how to decide whether or not the new decision from the Court of Appeals should be retroactively decided or not. That we should look at the fact that the court changed the law, which is what happened in the Canterbury case, that prior to Canterbury, what Jewel did could not be done. We should look at the facts in this case and the fact that Art was relying on the fact that the property was in joint tenancy, which is clear.
I was going to ask you about that, Ms. Pius, if I can interrupt you. What evidence, and I would tend to agree with you that Taylor changed the law, so you got, at least you got me on that piece of Chevron, but in terms of finding an inequity to apply this retroactively, it does seem to me that Art would have had to have relied on the joint tenancy. Was there any evidence that Art actually relied on that?
I think the evidence that was presented was both of the wills of the party that talk about how the property was in joint tenancy and that they both were going to agree that they would not change that, that the property was to go to the other party and then be divided between the two families, one half to his family, one half to her family, whether it went to her first or went to him first. So it's contained in the wills of the parties that they both knew it was in joint tenancy.
So, I don't recall, I don't think I've even looked at the will, tell you the truth, in terms of what I looked at in the record, but the will specifically refer to the joint tenancy in both wills?
But, well, no,
the
not...
First, the first will of both
yes,
of them.
The first will of both of the parties referred to the fact that it was in joint tenancy and that it was then going to be divided after, and particularly the fact in Art's will that says he would not change his will after Jewel died, so that he would not later try to deed the property to somebody else. That's contained in the will itself and was, in fact, turns out was followed by Art. On the issue of undue influence, the appellant would like the court to say that that's not possible because of the intent being expressed specifically in Jewel's will doing with her half the property. However, in the case of estate of Vic cited by the appellant, the court actually found that even though there was a mistake, the jury was proper in finding undue influence because it was clear that the mistake was based on information that had been supplied by the heirs and needed to be rectified in that case. And so even though they didn't go into detail about what that undue influence might have been, they clearly addressed the fact that it was proper for the jury to find undue influence when a mistake had been made. Just like in this case, a mistake was made. In the Vic case, it was the same type of mistake where the mother thought that the father was going to leave all the property to the sons, so she had a deed created, had the father sign it, even though there was some question as to his competency, and then she deeded her property, her half, what she thought was her half the property, to her daughters to ensure that they did get what they were entitled to. After the mother died, it was discovered that in fact he did not leave all of the property to his sons. He left half the property to his sons and half the property to his daughters. We have that exact same case here where, based on a mistake, the court was able to find that undue influence was sufficient. In this case, that undue influence was clearly presumed and not rebutted when it was clear that the children here procured the will, had it prepared on their direction, allegedly on the basis of what their mother had told her to do, them to do. But they are the ones that went to the attorney. The attorney drafted it on their direction, took it to Jewel while she was in a nursing facility post-hospitalization and signed it. He never saw her before. He never saw her afterwards.
But also, didn't the attorney, Mr. Maines, discuss the will with Jewel? Wasn't that his testimony?
He did testify that he discussed it with Jewel, and he thought that she understood what was going on and what he was attempting to do on her behalf.
And was there any contrary testimony?
The contrary testimony came from Mr. Kirkpatrick, who was the 30-year friend and attorney for both of these parties, testifying that it would not have been possible for Jewel to understand what she was doing there. If she had understood what she was doing, she would have told Art, and Art certainly would have told him.
But weren't there doctors who looked at Jewel before Mr. Maines met with her?
I don't think that there were any specific, there was no specific testimony that any doctors had concluded that she was capable of understanding anything that he told her. That was not the evidence in this case.
All right. You've kind of led me to where I was. One issue that concerns me, and I'll just be upfront with you, I think the other side, your colleague here, colleagues admit that there is a presumption.
Yes.
But I'm not so clear on what evidence there was to indicate Jewel's will was overborne when it comes to deciding if the presumption was rebutted. So maybe you can help me with that.
I believe that the evidence showed that her will was overcome because she did not know what she was doing when she signed that bargain and sale deed, or she intentionally kept that from Art. We believe that she really probably did not know what she was doing, and so it was their will, not her will, that was being prepared by Mr. Maines.
But the only evidence of that was from Mr. Kirkpatrick, who is, you know, saying, gee, in my view, I don't think she would have done that.
I think he based that, though, on the fact that he had seen her before. He had talked to her when he prepared his draft of her will, and he talked to her many times afterwards, that had she done something like that knowingly, she would have told him about it.
Yeah, but isn't that speculative?
I don't think that it certainly didn't come across as speculative when Mr. Kirkpatrick was testifying, and I don't think the court took it as speculative. I think the court implied that when the court said that Mr. Maines clearly did not have all the facts at the time that he talked to Jewel, particularly the fact that the parties had an understanding about how the property was to be divided. They went about it differently.
So when you say that she, her will was overborne, it wasn't so much that she wasn't voluntarily changing the will, but that there was an unanticipated consequence of the way that they set it up. Does that qualify in the realm of undue influence?
Well, I think in this case it qualifies, because I think that since Jewel didn't know what she was doing so much as it wasn't that she tried to make a change that she thought would do exactly what she wanted, but that she didn't understand that by doing that she was thwarting Art's wishes as well. On the issue of mistake, I would again ask the court here to look at the Kilpatrick case cited by the appellant in the brief for the mistake will not, if there's no fraud in the mistake in order to invalidate a will. But in fact, in that case, the court found that it was appropriate to create a constructive trust when the will did not accurately reflect what both of the parties understood to be the case, particularly where there, in that case, as in this case, the court looked at both wills, the husband's will and the wife's will, and when you put them together, you need to do something to rectify the mistake that was being made. And that leads to the last point I'd like to make, which is that the court here could have and should have reformed the wills.
Doesn't that depend on whether there's a contract, though, or an agreement between Jewel and Art?
And I think that there was testimony from Mr. Kirkpatrick that there was an agreement.
Doesn't it, under 15.11.514, Colorado Revised Statutes, doesn't such an agreement in Colorado need to be in writing?
I believe it is normally in writing, but I think that other evidence can be taken into consideration as to what the intent of the parties was, and that one of the major concerns of the entire probate statute is to implement the intent of the parties. And in Colorado, we are going to have a new law come July that allows the court to reform. I know that was not the law at the time that Judge Dickinson decided this case. However, the general law that intent should be the controlling principle has been the law in Colorado for some time, and ongoing consideration in many different varieties. In the Lewis case, the court looked at unjust enrichment and considered how the relationship between the parties and the fact that they ought to set aside something that was done. In this case, what we're saying is that the court ought to have set aside the wills and done what the court knew was the intent of the parties, because the court did find that it was clear as to what that intent was, which
when
was to
when you're talking about intent of the parties, though, that's a little bit different from a formal agreement between the parties. I mean, two people can sort of intend something and not have really a formal agreement about it.
That's correct. But whether it's a contract, or as in the Lewis case, there was no particular contract, there was simply an understanding between the parties. And that's what we have here, is an understanding between the parties that one half was to go to his family and one half was to go to her family. I think one of the things that is an issue that perhaps this court will want to address, which is that the new statute 1511-806 is going to be applied come July 2010. But it's also going to apply to any cases that are pending before the court, regardless of when the will was written. And in this case, this matter is still going to be pending before the court come July 2010.
Well, doesn't the General Assembly intend statutes to operate prospectively, number one? And number two, when the General Assembly creates a statute that clearly changes the law, as this appears to have done, the presumption is that the law was different before it was enacted.
I agree that is the presumption, but I think that just as we do in the presumption that ongoing cases are affected by a change in judicially created law, the presumption is that it would be just prospective, but in fact there are situations when it ought to be applied retroactively, and the court has, or the legislature has, opened that up by providing that cases that are then pending can be decided by the court using that.
Are they talking about the appellate pending or the trial court pending? I mean, if you tried a case after the statute became effective, I could see it, but I'm not sure about pending on appeal when the trial court's already made findings of fact.
I agree with Your Honor. It is not at all clear what that case is currently pending before the court is going to mean. Of course, nothing has been brought on appeal yet under that particular rationale. But the right to reform a will was not absolutely forbidden prior to this change in the law. In fact, again, the intent of the entire probate statute is to effectuate the intent of the parties. And here that intent has been was extremely clear to the trial court. The court was not able to do it as directly as he might have, or did not do it as directly as he might have, but he used it, the clear intent of the parties, he used that to make a finding of undue influence. And we would ask this court to affirm that finding of undue influence and or consider letting the judge reform the will to implement the true intent of the parties. Thank you.
Thank you.
On rebuttal, I'd first like to address the issue of retroactivity of Taylor v. Canterbury. The Martin Marietta v. Lorenz case, which is cited in the briefs, states that as a general rule, statutes operate prospectively while judicial decisions are applied retrospectively. I think that first factor needs to be looked at a little bit. The first factor for only prospective application needs to be looked at a little more clearly. The decision to be applied non-retroactively must establish a new principle of law either by overruling a clear precedent on which litigants relied, or by deciding an issue of first impression whose resolution was not clearly foreshadowed. The Taylor v. Canterbury case was clearly foreshadowed. Colorado was the very last state to implement this rule, and the line of cases that started in the 60s with the Minnesota case. This case overruled the straw man requirement, which was based on the four unities of property, which is clearly an arcane concept which serves no purpose.
Well, there's no question, though, that the issue in Colorado was a matter of first impression, right?
Right, and it was very clearly foreshadowed. And we were the 50th of 50 states to implement that rule.
So a division of this court just went off half-cocked?
It appears so.
This court didn't seem to think it was so reasonably, so well foreshadowed.
Unless you were in that division.
Touché. And I was not. But I'd like you, Mr. Mack, and I appreciate what you're saying. What concerns me, and I can only speak for myself, is the inequitability argument. And I would, if you wouldn't mind, address that and address Ms. Paez's statement that the joint tenancy issue was specifically noted in both in Jewel's first will and Art's will.
Well, I'd like to, I will address the reliance issue. With the fact that you could still sever a joint tenancy unilaterally, you just needed a straw man before this case. He could have conveyed it to his attorney and had it conveyed back, and that would have accomplished the same thing. So relying on the fact that a joint tenancy could not be unilaterally severed would have been a bad thing to rely on. I've got to go back to the issue of intent, because I think that really is the heart of this case. With regard to the statement that I was talking about Jewel's intent with respect to her property, I'd refer the court to page 8 of volume 3 of the transcript, where the court does say that Jewel's concern in going to Mr. Maines was that her half of the property would not get to her children.
But didn't the court say that in the context of finding the statements admissible? I mean, that was the context of the court's conclusion. It wasn't a finding of fact, was it?
I agree, but then the court does go on to give credence to Mr. Maine's opinion at the end of that paragraph and say that he's a disinterested party whose testimony I'm taking into account. With regard to the two different intents, the simple fact here is that her intent with regard to her husband's property is not her testamentary intent. It's only her intent with regard to her own property. She wanted her property to go to her children, and her intent with regard to their joint property is irrelevant for the purpose of the undue influence analysis. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion.